This lecture, entitled Slavery in Egypt, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Dr. and Mrs. Avi and Beth Adler and their family. Our slavery in Egypt and our subsequent redemption occupies a central place in Judaism. Every day of rest, Shabbos and Yom Tov, is at least partially a zecher letzias Mitzrayim, a tribute and a memorial to the exodus from Egypt and our freedom from slavery. The first in our cycle of holidays, Pesach, Passover, and especially the Seder night, is solely based upon that theme. The Geula and Shibud, slavery redemption, are of such primary importance that when God spoke to us face to face, as recorded in Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments, the very first words uttered were, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Tzisicha Meretz Mitzrayim Ebeis Avodim. I'm the Lord your God who has brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. In last year's lectures, entitled The Creation of the Eternal People, Part 1, From Abraham to the Egyptian Exile, we cover the events that led up to Jacob, moving his family from the land of Canaan to Egypt. Even though they were now in Golis and exile, as long as Jacob was still alive, it seems that the Jews lived in total isolation, unaffected by the environment around them. At the end of the first lecture of this year's series, we quoted from Rabbeinu Bachya, who commented on the fact that the normal spacing in the text between the Parshas, the weekly Torah portions, does not occur between the end of Parshas Vayigash and the beginning of Parshas Vayechi. And the Vayechi is the last of the section, and there's the normative spacing is not there. They appear in the Sefer Torah as if there would be just one narrative without any separation, and this is highly unusual. Parshas Vayechi deals with the death of Jacob, and begins with the word, and Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, and the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. The first reason the Rabbeinu Bachya gives following the approach of Rashi and the Medrash is, quote, this section, this parsha, is satuma, literally closed, connected to the last section without a break for two reasons. First, because the exile was beginning now and their heart was closed from the pain of the enslavement. Basically, the closeness it represents really the person, the heart is closed. You don't feel that, you don't have feeling. You're numbed. And it was a sense of numbness that they experienced. Even though the actual servitude did not immediately begin with Jacob's passing, but it marked the end of the period of total isolation and the beginning of acculturation and a reduction in their spiritual level. Hence, the first phase in the process of enslavement. This seems to be an explanation of the phrase, a closed heart. They no longer had the sensitivity of heart that came with the spiritual level because Yaakov passed away. It's interesting to note that even before the Jews were enslaved, Yosef cemented Pharaoh's power in the land and reduced the general Egyptian populace to a position of serfdom. This is how the Torah describes these events, and it's the first page of your lecture notes. And there's no bread, there was no bread in the land, in all of the land, for the famine was very severe. So the land of Egypt and all of the land of Canaan fainted because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, for the grain for which they bought. And they gathered up the money to give, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all of the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money is gone." It's interesting to note, as we're going to touch upon this, the people of the land of Canaan did not come. Only the the people of Egypt. And Joseph said, give me your cattle. I'll give you food for your cattle if your money is gone. And they brought their cattle to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for the flocks and for the cattle of the herds, for the donkeys, and he fed them with bread for all their cattle for that year. When that year was ended, they came to him the second year and said to him, we'll not hide it from my Lord that our money is spent. My Lord also has our herds of cattle. There's nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Why shall we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants to Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die. The land may not be not desolate. And it's interesting, again, here we have the mention of seed. This whole story was predicated on the dream that there would be 7 years of famine. And they collected food for 7 years. Yet only after some 2 years, already they're asking for seed. We're going to touch upon this. And Joseph bought all of the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field because of the famine prevailed over them, so the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, now he moved them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end of it. And again, we'll discuss why is this so. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, because the priests had a portion assigned to them from Pharaoh, and ate their portions which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their lands. And again, we'll discuss why is this important. Why does the text mention this about the priests? The Netziv, and this is Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the last Rosh Yeshiva and the Yeshiva in Volozhin, he died in 1893, explains this section in the following manner. Here's on page 2. And it was interesting that the term used was V'lechem ein b'chol ha'oretz. There's no bread. He didn't say there was no food. There was no bread. And the Netziv explains, for this reason they couldn't bake regular bread, but only bread that consists of a little grain which is mixed with bran and other substances. There was food, but it was very meager and very coarse. And what they wanted was the bread that they were accustomed to. And it continues on, so that the land of Egypt, all of the land of Canaan, fainted because of the famine. Not because they were necessarily starved to death, but he says this is because it was difficult for them to endure eating such food. And he continues on the Hamak Dover. This is the Netziv, and this is the work of the Hamak Dover. And when they came to, it says, when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and Canaan, and all the Egyptians came to Joseph, give us bread. So why should we die in your presence? For the money is gone. And he says, after this, there's no more mention about what happened in the land of Canaan. We'd already explained that there was available in Canaan animal fodder that was barely digestible by humans. We had quoted the Netziv in a lecture last year that originally Yaakov was planning just to go down himself and his children and leave the servants back home. They wouldn't have starved to death, but they would have eaten this very coarse, difficult food, and he would have left it for the slaves to eat. So he says they actually could subsist, but it was just with great difficulty. Those who were delicate, though, and found it very difficult to eat such food, made the effort to import grain. In Egypt, however, before the Nile rose, absolutely no vegetation grew. So there was really nothing for them. It was after their what was left of the original vegetation or the bran, there was absolutely nothing for them to eat in Egypt at all. Whereas in Canaan, They decided to just make do rather than sell themselves and their cattle and everything to the Egyptians. Now, the HaMikdavar explains what is the necessity, what is it telling us about the fact that Joseph moved the people from one city to the next. Now, Rashi explains this to mean that he did this knowing that his family is there, is coming to Goshen. They're strangers. They'll be looked at as aliens. So the fact is, he moved everyone from city to city. No one had roots anymore. They were all aliens, and he did it really for the benefit of his family. The Netziv, though, learns has a different view of this, and he says as follows: we've already explained the rationale of Yosef, for it was in order to clear out the land of Goshen. For that reason, all of these details were written in the Torah in order to elucidate the great effort that Yosef exerted in order to ensure the Yisroel would dwell alone. In other words, he really wanted to empty the land of the natives, the land of Goshen, that area that the Jews would eventually settle in. He wanted to make sure that they would be isolated and not part of the common culture. So he wanted to move the people, the natives, out of Goshen. He, according to the Netziv, he couldn't do that. There would be too much of an uproar to move them because of the Jews. So what he planned was that it would be a general rule that everyone who had sold themselves as slaves would be forced to move out of their native land. And therefore, that's how he was able to move the natives of Goshen as well. So it was really a ruse, so to speak. It was an excuse for him to do so, and it would not meet with much resistance now that he emptied Goshen of its natives, because everyone was being emptied. And he continues on, and it's the explanation of the phrase "to cities" is that Yosef didn't exile them as lone individuals to separate places. Rather, the members of each city were exiled as a group to another city in order they not lose their sense of community. And probably he doesn't go on to explain this, but in all probability, it's the he needed them. They were the people of Egypt. They had to produce. They had to be happy. At least even though that he took away their sense of land, of connection to the land, at least they had their society. And they would be, therefore, they would still be able to function well, and the country as a whole would be able to function well. After all, he was the viceroy, Yosef. It was his job to ensure the success of the country. So here he had his plan to make sure that his family settle in a land that would be devoid of the local populace. But on the other hand, he had to make sure that would ensure the best interests of the country of Egypt. Now, by the fact that Yosef gave them seed would seem to indicate that the famine had come to an end, as we pointed out before. Although only some 2 years had passed of the predicted 7 years, our sages, as quoted by Rashi, explained that Yaakov's coming to Egypt was the cause of the abatement of the famine. With Yosef's assistance, they were all now able to plant and sustain themselves. And so bracha came. When Yaakov came, he blessed Pharaoh, basically blessed the land. And the Egyptians understood that their success really came because of Yaakov. As we'll see later on, when Yaakov did die, they afforded him really a royal burial. Regarding the Torah's emphasis on the fact that the Egyptian priests were free from paying taxes, Rav Yaakov Mecklenburg, in his Sefer, says, Ksav HaKabbalah, comments, and here's on page 3. The land of the priests he did not buy, because the priests had a portion assigned to them from Pharaoh, and ate their portion which Pharaoh gave them, therefore they did not sell their lands. And as it's stated in the notes on the bottom of page 2, that all of the Egyptians, after given over the land, were actually were taxed. In other words, they were settlers in Pharaoh's land and had to pay Pharaoh a fifth of the produce. That was their rental fee, so to speak. The priests had no rental fee. The lands were never taken away from them. It always belonged to them. And the Ksava Kabbalah explains here, the commentators have not elucidated the purpose of this information, why the priests did not, you know, were free from these taxes. Not only was this stated here, but Scripture repeated this at the end of this narrative. Because it's stressed twice. The idea that they did not give over their lands, the priests did not give over their lands to Pharaoh, because their food was supplied by Pharaoh. So there was no need for them to give over their lands. And it repeats they did not pay this tax. It seems to me that Yosef had in mind with this dispensation to bring great benefit to the household of his father. For with displacing the people, this is his theory, of course, really he was helping the Jews by doing so. Just as the Hamakdover explained that moving the people from the cities, or even Rashi explained, had in mind to help the Jews. Either that they shouldn't have the stigma of being strangers, according to Rashi, or according to the Hamakdover, the fact is the land would no longer have, of Goshen would no longer have its natives, and the Jews would be isolated. This too, freeing the priests from taxes, was part of the plan to help Yosef's family. And he explains as follows. For with displacing the people from their cities so that no one remained holding his own land, he also removed the original inhabitants of the land of Goshen to another land. In other words, we explained this, the Netzivit said this, and the Ksava Kabbalah also says this, and placed there his father's household. His father's household, however, would have remained like all the other residents of the land and would be forced to give a fifth of their produce to Pharaoh. This is why he implemented his plan that the priests would eat of the portion assigned to them, and therefore, he says, that's also part of Joseph's plan. And therefore, their land wouldn't be sold to Pharaoh, and as a result, they would be free from giving a fifth to Pharaoh. Because of this, his brothers were also free from the 20% tax, as the shepherds played an important role in the eyes of the Egyptians, as they raised those animals that were considered to be Egyptian deities, as was evident from that which is stated above. In other words, they view these sheep as incarnates of these deities, of these gods, and that's why they held shepherds as a class in low regard, because they slaughtered these animals and ate these animals, which the Egyptians held to be gods. But they did, though, serve a purpose. They wanted shepherds. He felt the shepherds had gone beyond their responsibilities and had violated it by eating these animals. But they felt that they were doing a necessary service for the land of Egypt. They felt having these flocks would bring a blessing to the land. They were similar to the priests, the ministers of their gods. So just as they were free from paying tax, the priests were, so too those who sustained their gods. So that's how Joseph could justify to the populace and to Pharaoh why his parents, his family was not being taxed. And that's why it is written, and they had possession in it, the Jews, for the land of Goshen was their possession, for they didn't have to pay any taxes, in contradistinction to the other residents of Egypt who didn't have it as a quote-unquote possession. That is why they had to pay a fifth. As we stated before, with the death of Yaakov, an era came to an end. We quote here on the bottom of page 3, regarding the death of Yaakov, Jacob, and Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew near that Israel, that's another name for Jacob, for Israel, Yaakov, must die. And he called his son Yosef and said to him, if now I find grace in your sight, put, I beg you, your hand under my thigh. They explain this as really, it's a euphemism referring that the place of the milah, which really represents the covenant of the between God and the Jews, that when one makes an oath, he holds a holy object. He viewed this, the sign of the covenant, as a holy object. And deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I beg you, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will, and Joseph said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. And he swore to him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. And it continues on after he had died. We discussed in the previous lecture the blessings that, or the rebuke that Yaakov said in his last moments of life before he died. And it continues on, all these are the tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them, referring to the blessings, and blessed them. Everyone according to his blessing, he blessed them. And he charged them and said to them, and look at the great detail this is said. I'm gathered to my people, buried with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephraim, the Hittite, the Hitti, and in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, because there shouldn't be any mistake, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan. Mamre has great significance. That's where Avram was. That's where when the angels came, which Avram bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for possession of a burying place. And they buried Avram and Sarah his wife, and there they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And this is Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka. There I buried Leah. The purchase of the land and the cave that is in it was from the Hittites. Remember this, that it was not just a private purchase, it was really done with the consent of the people. And the commentaries explain this, that it was, the Hittites were an ethnic group. They did not sell their land to foreigners. You know, there are countries who are very, in China and other areas about selling companies or selling land. They want the land belonging, remaining to them. They'll lease the land, but they will not sell the land. Avram wanted to buy the land. That's where originally he came. There's the whole story with the Hittites. Says, I need a land for burials. They said, we'll give it to you. In other words, we'll let you use our land. No, says, no, I want to buy it. I want it to be mine. And he made sure that not only was a private sale, but it was approved by all of the people. Therefore, he really had complete title to this land. As there would be no question that who the owners were. And when Jacob finished commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and expired, was gathered unto his people. The Netziv comments, the reason for this long description of the burial plot was to teach Yaakov's descendants the key elements to look for in choosing a burial plot. In other words, these should be the principles to look for. One, the place was a holy area. It was in the land of Canaan, the chosen land. It was also being in, right before Mamre, this is in Machpelah, it was a unique area within the land of Canaan. According to tradition, Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, were buried in that same area, that same cave. So one is the choice because of the sanctity of the land. The sanctity was palpable. That's for this reason there are people, I mean, this is a whole discussion of the Gemara and Ksubas at the end, in Kuf Yud Aleph, 111a, about being buried in Israel. But it's part of that principle. Two, it was the land that Avram had purchased from Ephraim, the Zachiti. And it was done, was confirmed by the entire Hittite nation. So basically a person should be buried in a plot that belongs to him. It's not stolen. You can't get, the owners can't decide, okay, we're going to go remove the plot now. This is really a major problem in burial places in Eastern Europe, where the people feel, the government feels, okay, it's all over. We want to use it for a sports stadium, for a parking lot, for buildings. If you have title for it, it's yours. No one can touch it. And third, it was also the place where his whole family was buried. It was a family burial plot. This is a place where his wife was buried. In the sense that, that really you're buried together with the entire family, which is a nechama, which is a consolation for a person. This is also, you see in this. So part of the detail was really to teach us this principle. And scripture continues on, now this is on page 4, with the detail of the burial. Because you could look at it on your own about the burial. He was given a royal burial and there was bitter lamentation. They really felt, the Egyptians felt, that the loss of a holy man like Yaakov was really a loss for the entire Egyptian nation. And it goes in details of how he was buried. The end of the book of Genesis ends off with Yosef, and we could read this short thing. This is on page 5 in paragraph D. And Yosef lived in Egypt, he and his father's house. And Yosef lived 110 years. And Yosef saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. It does interpret really, it's the children of the third generation. So really it was the... And also says the children of Mocher, the son of Manasseh, brought upon Yosef's knees. So really, in terms of Ephraim, he saw great-grandchildren. In terms of the children of Mocher, the son of Manasseh, also Mocher, the son of Manasseh, Mocher was his grandchild. And the children of Mocher was the third gen, great grandchildren. But when it came to Ephraim, they interpret really it was great great grandchildren. Because he saw really children of the third generation. So it was a tremendous blessing that he saw all of these children. And Yosef said to his brothers, I die, and God will surely visit you, with to remember you, and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. And Yosef took an oath from the people of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, remember you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. And the Torah really makes a point that Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, saw to it. He went and took out the bones of the body of Yosef and made sure that it was carried with them. So Yosef died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, put in a coffin in Egypt. This is how the book of Genesis, Sefer Bereishis, ends. Sefer Shmos, the book of Exodus, continues on just with a short review. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt, with Jacob, every man with his household, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Binyamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all of the souls who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all of his brothers, and all on all that generation. This is really now the beginning of the slavery. So just a short review of how they came. They flourished. And after that first generation died, a new era began. Now the
did the rest of the brothers were left in Egypt?
Yes, the entire family was left in Egypt, and it continues on here on page 5 and number 2, and Yosef died and his brothers and all the generation. This teaches us, this is from the Medrash, that as long as any of the original, Rashi quotes, as long as any of the original group that came down to Egypt was still alive, they did not enslave the Jews. I mean, again, there are different levels of slavery, but the actual enslaving them did not occur. But it seems, first and foremost, that really the period of absolutely no public service and no slavery at all was kept up until the death of Levi. Afterwards, there was a gradual progression. So it seems, even though that whole generation, it could very well be that there were those who lived after Levi, but the process began with Levi's death. And then complete slavery came, it seems, when they all died. We quote here the Medrash Seder Olam on top of page 6. Yosef was 110 when he died. None of the founders of the tribes lived as short a life as Yosef. This is a tradition that they maintain. And none of the tribe lived as long as Levi, who lived to be 137 years old. As long as Levi was alive, this reiterates that the Medrash, the idea of the Medrash we quoted before, the Egyptians did not enslave Israel. As it says, and Yosef died, and all of his brothers and all of that generation. But they put the brothers as one category and generation as another category. So evidently, with the death of the brothers, one period came to an end. The death of the generation, another period came to an end. There rose up a new king over Egypt who knew not Yosef. So when Levi died, the Egyptians began to enslave the Jews. From here did the process began. Our sages deduce the saying, and this is a very difficult passage which we're going to explain. If one of the brothers dies, all of the brothers should worry. If one of the group dies, all of the group should worry. And as a person is part of a group, and one of the friends die, it may be a gzeira, chas v'shalom. It may be a decree upon the group as a whole. There's something to be fearful. Chas v'shalom, as a member of the family dies, maybe not be a sole unique event, but really part of a gzeira, of a decree on the family. It seems tradition has this, that the initial meeting about enslaving the Jews occurred, and this is how the Vilna Gaon explains, occurred when Yosef died. You know, as you know, familiar with bureaucracies and governments, it takes time for things to happen. The initial meeting occurred when Yosef died. And according to the Medrash, three advisors were there with Pharaoh at that meeting. There was Yisro, who was destined to be the father-in-law of Moshe. There was Eov, Job, and there was Bilam. Bilam was the one who pushed for enslavement of the Jews. Yisro came to their defense. And Eov, Job, was silent. This is how tradition records this. Because of the resistance that Yisro's ideas were not accepted by Pharaoh, Yisro fled. Yisro, who was then an advisor, fled back to Midian, his native land. Job, who was silent, soon afterwards experienced the bitter suffering that is recorded in the book of Job. It says that subsequent to that suffering, and after this is in great detail, and his friends came to him, and he viewed life differently subsequently, he was blessed with an additional 140 years of life. So all in all, it says that he lived to be 210 years, Job. He was 70 when he came, that incident with the advice, and he was silent. And he lived 140 years afterwards. And the Medrash says he was born around the time when the Jews originally came to Egypt. And he died around the time the Jews left Egypt. This incident with Pharaoh toying with the idea of enslaving the Jews, occurred at the end, after the death of Joseph, approximately 70 years after the Jews came down to Egypt. So the Vilna Gaon explains, therefore, when one member of the group dies, you have to worry, because the process began. It wasn't implemented, but the idea already stuck. And once there's an idea, it may take years for it to come to fruition. But finally, when Levi died, then they decided we're going to start taking action. So this is how the Vilna Gaon explains this. Just as an aside, the Brisker Rav, of Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, who was the last Rav in the city of Brest-Litovsk, Brisk, in Poland, explained that why is it that Job suffered so much, at least according to this Medrash. And Job was really silent when the idea of persecuting the Jews was presented. The idea, the feeling was, well, he felt he couldn't do anything anyway. Bilaam was a very persuasive advisor. Yisro, who countered it, it was totally rebuffed. So Job felt the best thing was to keep silent. So what he should have done, the Brisker Rebbe explains, says, is that he should have protested, even though it wouldn't have been effective. So if it really bothered him, he should have cried out in pain. How could you let such a people be enslaved and suffer so much? Because the acquiescence and the pain of, you know, that was destined to occur to the Jews, and he was quiet. He was punished by suffering pain himself, and that was a pain that he wasn't so stoic when he suffered his own pain. And the lesson is, when it's painful, even if it doesn't, it's not going to help, but at least it's an expression that you recognize the pain. And the Brisker Rebbe really said this. It was in the early days of the state. And there was a question about making protests about what was happening, and there were about a lack of sensitivity of the leaders of the state who were secular about the religious feelings and about Shabbos. And there was a question about having a protest which may not be even effectual. But he says, "Venesutut ve'daf min shvayin," at least expresses the pain, the anguish that you have. Joshua's don't sit there stoically as if nothing occurred. And he brought the proof here from the story of Job, of Eve. But I'll go upon him. In any case, this is from the Medrash, seems the process really began with Yosef's death. And that's why I said one should worry when one of a group dies. But it only came to fruition when Levi finally died, when he was 137. This is some years afterwards. And while all of this was happening, the Jews enjoyed a tremendous growth in population. And here we have on page 6, paragraph F, "And the people of Israel were fruitful, increased abundantly, and multiplied, became exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." But this growth, this population growth, went hand in hand with the beginnings of acculturation as well. And we quote here from two Midrashim. The first one is the Medrash Yalkut Shimoni in Parsha Shmos. "The land was filled with them." Rabbi Yochanan said they filled the land of Egypt, means physically. Another explanation, because there's so many of them, they went out of Goshen and they went all over. And the next one is the theaters and circuses became filled with them. Or at least what would be the Egyptian equivalent of theaters and circuits. In other words, they became really part of the Egyptian culture because they wanted to fit in. They wanted to be like the Egyptians. Immediately, they decreed that they should separate themselves from them. The Egyptians, we don't want the Jews. To the extent the Jews wanted to be accepted by them, that's what triggered the Gzeira, the decree. The Jews, they didn't want anything to have any part in the Jews. And we quote from the other Medrash in the Shmos Rabbah here. The rabbis commenced this subject by citing the following verse. "They have dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they have fathered alien children. Now a month, Chodesh, shall devour them with their portions." The simple meaning, the Chodesh is really, we spell it out with a vov, because that's how it's pronounced. It's really in the prophet, it's spelled ches dalet shin without the vov. But it's pronounced with the O sound, the cholam. And the chodesh, the month referring is, the commentary is referring, it's an allusion to the month of Ov, the month of the destruction of the temple. This, But they understand this to mean, I guess, another level of meaning, that when Yosef died, they annul the covenant of circumcision. They said, let us become like the Egyptians. This comes to teach you that Moshe circumcised them when they left Egypt. But they were not circumcised during this period. In other words, it had fallen into disuse. And it seems the reason is also because they wanted to fit in. Since they did so, the Holy One, blessed be, turned around the love the Egyptians had for them into hatred, as it is stated in Scripture. He turned around their heart to hate his people, to entrap his servants. It's a quote from Psalms 105. This is a fulfillment of the verse which we started quoting in Hosea. Now a chodesh, which is literally a month, but it's spelled without a vav, it's chodosh. V'yokam melech chodosh. It's the same spelling of the new king came, a new era began, which shall devour them and their forces with their portions, because they wanted really to become one with the Egyptians. When they become one with the Egyptians, this is why Hashem created this decree. Now, according to the Beis HaLevi was the Beis of Dober Soloveitchik, the first in the line of Soloveitchiks who were Rabbonim, rabbis in the city of Brisk. He died approximately in the year in 1892. They did not totally abandon the practice of milah circumcision. Rather, they first performed circumcision and then covered it up. It's called moshech or losel. In other words, they cut it off so they minimally. But afterwards, they pulled it back up, should it adhere to the skin, so they should look. As they fulfilled the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. They did not maintain it as an ospris, as a sign of the covenant, but at least they did cut it off. So, see, they would look like Egyptians and blend in. We've been in a lecture many years ago. We quoted from Josephus in the Book of Maccabees that when the Jews in the Greek period, right before the Hanukkah revolt, wanted to assimilate, they also did similar, that they pulled the skin. They made an operation to look as if they would be uncircumcised, so they should blend in. Now, because they performed the gymnastics without having any clothes. So they wanted to look like there, they wanted to look like the Greeks. According to the Medrash, then persecution against the Jews and dislocation is not caused because the Jews look and act differently, but on the contrary, it occurs when they try to hide their Jewishness and blend in. It's a divine punishment to ensure the Jews remain apart. To the extent they want to be the same, that's when the decrees occur. The Egyptian experience serves as a prototype, it would seem, for all future exiles, and the tension between the Jews who wish to assimilate and the anti-Semites who would rather see the Jews be kept apart and not to infiltrate their society. This has become a recurring theme in our history. It happened in Spain, and most recently in Tsarist Russia and Nazi Germany. To the extent that Jews wanted to become part of society, they, with great fury, the society rejected them. In the words of the Gemara in Psochem, it's Kuf Yud Ches Amud Beis 118b, and this is in the bottom, page 6, is he hath scattered the people that delight in approaches, is a verse in Psalm 68. And they interpret, what caused Israel to be scattered amongst the nations? The approaches to the nations which they desired. To the extent they wanted to blend in, Providence had it. They were forced, really, to be separate. Now the Torah describes how the enslavement actually began. Here on page 7, this is, there arose a new king over Egypt, who knew, this is in the first chapter in Exodus, who knew not Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it may come to pass that when there be any war, they should join our enemies and fight against us. As they came really with a claim that they're not true citizens, they're not loyal. So get them out of that which I'm quoting here is really the is the translation of Jewish Publication Society. And they explain, and if they'll fight against them, so get them out of the land, which means, and then the Jews will leave the land. We have to keep the Jews here. The Talmud really understands this as a euphemism, to be that they will unite against our enemies and we will be exiled. As a euphemistically, we say they will be exiled. But it really means, this is according to the Talmud, this is a euphemism for saying they will take over and we, the natives, will be forced to go into exile. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pisa and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were mortified because of the people of Israel. And the Egyptians made the people of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard slavery and mortar and brick and all kinds of service in the field. All their service which they made them serve was with rigor. Now, in terms of the dating of this, here we quote here in paragraph B on page 7, and the people of Israel were fruitful, increased abundantly, and multiplied, and there rose up a new king over Egypt who knew not Yosef. He said, we ascertain from the time that Levi died until Israel left Egypt, there was 116 years. The slavery did not commence before the time. It lasted for at least a minimum of 86 years, which was from the time of the birth of Miriam. In other words, we know from the birth of Miriam, she's called Miriam from the word mar. Why was she called Miriam? Because of the bitterness, moror, that existed at the time of her birth. So we know the real bitterness occurred when she died, when she was born. That was 86 years before the Exodus. We know that it began, a process began, not just talking about it, but really implementing a process began at the death of Levi. Somewhere in between these years, right, you know, these 30 years, it came to a period when there were free citizens, where they were terribly enslaved with great bitterness. But it does not, evidently, tradition doesn't have the exact years when every step of the process occurred. We just know the two poles, so to speak, that it must have began at some point when Levi died, 116 years before the Exodus. And it was with its greatest fury and hurt 86 years before the Exodus. Now, it's interesting, in the Haggadah of Pesach, we quote from Parshas Kisavo, and it's Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 6, V'yoreo esona mitzriyim v'yanunu v'yitnu aleinu avoida kosha. This is commonly translated, the Egyptians dealt ill with us and afflicted us and laid upon us hard slavery. Many of the commentators, including Abravanel, explain the word vayoreu to mean not that they dealt ill with us, but they portrayed us as being evil people. Just over here, this was the complaint. They're not loyal citizens. They're really allied with our enemies. They portrayed us as being a kind of a fifth column. But this is also a recurring pattern in the history of anti-Semitism, and something that was clearly a major part of the Nazis' campaign against the Jews. In other words, it's important to me is the Egyptian slavery was really a prototype of future history. And what occurred, you know, what occurred to the Jews is really throughout our long history, and especially the Holocaust, is not unique. It's really a part of a process which began in Egypt. Now, what's clearly interesting is the opinion the Jews were actually tricked into working for Pharaoh. And this is you can look yourself, one of the interpretations of the word perach, which is backbreaking, rigorous work, also could be interpreted to be perach. That's not, as a hint, not the simple meaning. But the hint is perach is a soft mouth. They were smooth, in other words, through smooth talking, they were actually, that's how they got in to be enslaved. And we quote on page 8 here, from the Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah. At the time that Pharaoh said, come on, let us deal wisely with them, therefore did they set over them taskmasters. He gathered all of Israel and said to them, please work with me as a favor. In other words, this began as a volunteer, as a national effort to show your patriotism. This is the meaning of the verse, and the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with Perach. It's translated as rigor, but it means really, this is, and as he didn't immediately enslave them. It really went step by step. Which means with tender mouth, Pharaoh took a basket and shovel and began to make bricks. Anyone seeing Pharaoh taking a basket and a shovel making bricks automatically began working himself. Immediately, when they say immediately, this is a medrash, it doesn't necessarily mean that it happened in 5 seconds. No, but it means that it began the process. All of Israel worked with enthusiasm, worked together with him with all of their might as they possessed strength and courage. As soon as it became dark, Pharaoh arranged taskmasters and said to them, count the number of bricks that you made. They immediately got up to count them. He said to them, from now on, every single day you have to produce the same amount of bricks. As it started off as a volunteer, really now became, so not only were they enslaved, but they were enslaved with the same goal. So he appointed taskmasters over specially appointed officials of the people of Israel. In other words, the taskmaster didn't deal with every Jew. They dealt with Jews who were intermediate. It was like similar to the kapos. It was intermediates, and officials were appointed over the rest of the people. The Das Akanim, Bali Tosfos, has a slightly different version. According to this version of the Medrash, it was totally voluntary. Just, let's see, who could do the best job? Here, actually, another incentive was added, according to this Midrashic source, which is quoted in the Das Akanim. This is from the Bali Tosfos, the authors of the Tosfos. Originally, Pharaoh told each one of them, I will give you an award for each brick that you make. They all came and strained themselves because of their desire for reward and made more than they normally would be made. When Pharaoh saw how much they made, he told them to finish the quota which they made when payment was given them. In other words, you have to always do the same. But this is all part of different versions of the Perach. As it started off voluntarily and it became they became forced to do so. It's interesting also to note that not all of the Jews were enslaved. The tribe of Levi was not enslaved.
And is there a reason given why?
The next section here. On the bottom of page 8, we quote first the Medrash Rabbah in Perek Gimel in chapter 3 in Bamidbar Rabbah. God leads out, this is a verse in Psalms, God leads out the prisoners to prosperity, or what could be interpreted as bekoshros, says that through the righteous. And explains, through the merit of the righteous, ksherim amongst them, did they leave Egypt. Who were the righteous amongst them? They were the members of the tribe of Levi. Even though Israel worshipped strange gods, idols, while they were in Egypt, the tribe of Levi only served the Holy One, blessed be He, and performed circumcision upon themselves. As they did not become acculturated. They still maintained circumcision, and they did not become acculturated in terms of religion. And that's why Moshe praised them at the end of his life. He was about to die, as it says, for they have observed your word and kept your covenant. And this refers, they explain this, observed your word is referring to idolatry. They never worshipped idols. And kept your covenant. This is the bris milah, the covenant. They were always careful to keep this. Thus, it was because of the merit of the righteous amongst them, Israel left Egypt. The Medrash we quote on paragraph B now, in the first citation, this is from Shmos Rabbah, points out when Moshe and Aaron first came to Paro. wanted them to wanted the power of Pharaoh to free the Jews, and he told them just he told them basically leave. And he told them go back. Says Luchul Sivlusechem. Says go back to your burdens. And it's a funny thing. What does it mean to your burdens? Like it's a private burden. And the Midrash explains, meaning that they were not required to meet Pharaoh's burdens. The tribe of Levi was free. This is your own communal responsibility. Go back to your own work. But he would not tell them to go back to work for the governmental service because they were free. And this we quote here from the Midrash of Yeshua ben Levi said the tribe of Levi was free from the rigors of enslavement. Pharaoh told them, because you are free, do you say, let us go and offer sacrifices to our God? He says, go you to your burdens. In other words, just go home. You have a lot to take care of at home. He says, leave me alone. But they were free. Why were they free? So here, we quote here from, this is a number two, from the commentary of the Bali Tosfos. The tribe of Levi consists of Torah scholars. And they didn't want to engage in mundane work, for they knew that they were destined to carry the ark. Because of they remained free. We're going to explain this further. There's yet another explanation, because Pharaoh saw that Yaakov was a godly man and didn't want to trouble Levi to carry his coffin. In other words, we discussed this in the previous lecture, that how they carried the coffin of Yaakov was based on directives of Yaakov's. Says, made the directives. Yehuda says, Reuven, you go here, you go here. Yosef was not to carry it because of the royal privilege, but his two sons carried it. And Levi was not to carry it. And that was the directive that Yaakov made before he died. So he evidently, the reason Yaakov did it, the Levi's a holy man. So Pharaoh said, how can I bother Levi with mundane work? If you ask the question, Yosef also didn't carry the coffin. It says that since Yosef was a king, Yaakov honored him, even though he was his son. Now, however, his kingship came to an end. There's no reason to honor Yosef. So therefore, Yosef's progeny were enslaved. But Levi felt was a different kind of a person. This is the tradition that's recorded from the Bali Tosfos. The commentary of Chizkuni, he was from Provence, but he... his commentary was really a collection of the other great commentators, says the following. The reason why the tribe of Levi merited to be free from the slave in Egypt was because of the following. When Pharaoh originally enslaved Israel, Pharaoh also worked with them, in order they strained themselves to work, which we quoted before, as they expounded on the work, Beferach, Beferach, with a soft mouth. At that time, the tribe of Levi remembered what Yaakov had commanded at the time of his death, the Levi not carry the coffin, as he was destined to carry the holy ark. And since they didn't voluntarily commit themselves to work, Pharaoh didn't force them to do so. This is only those who volunteered were later forced. Levi never volunteered. Either it was because of their love for Torah study, as we were the Bali Tosfos. This is not for us. Our responsibility is to maintain the traditions of the family. Or it was because that they felt that they were bound, duty-bound, not to do so because they were like cut from a different cloth, so to speak. They were supposed to carry the holy ark from that time on. But since they didn't volunteer, it was established all those who volunteered before they conscripted. In addition, the Agoda preserved the tradition. Avram transmitted all of the Torah that he received to Yitzchak. Yitzchak in turn transmitted to Yaakov, who transmitted to Levi. Levi and his descendants created yeshivas in Egypt. Now, since they didn't know any other profession and solely devoted themselves to Torah study, they weren't enslaved in Egypt. I mean, first, they didn't volunteer, and Pharaoh didn't even want, he felt that they wouldn't even be good as slaves. Because the others were involved in their own activity. They were workers. So Levi were scholars. And in fact, they wouldn't make good workers anyway, so they just left them. And just as an addition to this, Eliyahu Lapian, the famed tzaddik in Baal Musar, quoting a medrash, explained that there was a rationing system that Pharaoh enacted. Those rations were only given out to those people who worked. The members of the tribe of Levi, although technically free from work, were not given rations. According to his understanding, how did they survive? I mean, they were scholars. So how did they survive? They only survived through the goodwill of the others who shared their meager rations with the tribe of Levi. The merit of the study of Torah that was Levi's was, according to Rav Lapian, actually shared with those that supported them. We said before that they left in the merit of the tribe of Levi, who continued on the traditions. In a sense, then, Shevet Levi was the model for the first Kollel. Not only the tribe of Levi merited redemption, as you quote at the end of page 8, but also those connected to the tribe of Levi, through their support, were redeemed together with them. It would stand to reason, then, that those who were not redeemed, and we have a tradition that 4/5 of them died in the plague of darkness, which we're going to describe in a future lecture, could very well be because they were not the supporters. This is not a fundraiser for the Kollel, but keep it in mind. Yeah. Although we have spoken of the Jews' desire to become acculturated to the extent of appearing as Gentiles without the Bris Mila, but in many other ways they were still connected with their roots. And here we have on page 10, a people apart. And Israel became there, says there in Egypt, a nation, Vahisham Lagoy. We say this in Agodah Shel Pesach. This is taken from Parshas Kisavo in Deuteronomy 26. This teaches the Jews stood out as a nation apart while they were there. In what way were they different? So the Medrash Tanna Dvei Eliyahu we have in paragraph B says the Jews left Egypt despite the fact they lived there for over 200 years. They had not changed their names or tongue into that of the dominant culture. In other words, they still spoke Lashon Kodesh, the holy tongue. And they still retained their names. So there was a certain level of acculturation, but it was limited. Now the Medrash Bamidbar Rabbah has it, says the Jews in Egypt had three special qualities, and through their merit they were redeemed. They didn't change their names, nor their language, and were very careful not to violate the code of morality. The Medrash recorded in Medrash Shir HaShirim as a fourth. Says they were also careful, says, not to speak Lashon Hara, to speak ill of others. Was also their merit. They kept in a certain, a certain high level. And the Medrash says about the inspiration in terms of their morality is they saw as an example, Sora was taken by force to Pharaoh's. Right? She did not submit herself to Pharaoh. She resisted. Yosef was tempted by Ashes Potiphar, the wife of his lord, his owner, Potiphar. He did not let himself be seduced. That strength of character carried was an inspiration for all of them. But it does seem, though, and we quote before, that they did worship idols. We quote on page 11, a Medrash, I'll just paraphrase this, that at the time of the splitting of the Red Sea, the guardian angel of Esau, really, according to this Medrash, there's another version that's the guardian angel of Egypt, there's the guardian angel of Esau in this Medrash, came to the aid of the Egyptians, and says, why should the Egyptians suffer here. The Jews are just as guilty as Egyptians. They're also idolaters. And God came to their defense and said they were really forced into it. They're pressured into it. They were not true idolaters. But it seems idolatry was really something that was really part of their culture too. They had adopted, except for Levi. We quote here, again, page 11 in number 2, in paragraph 2, that we quote from Yechezkel, that Hashem sent a prophet. Who the prophet? He spoke to the people of Israel while they were in Egypt to abandon their idols, and they refused. Who was the person who was sent by God to be the prophet? And as we quote here, this is really the Yalkut Shemoni. It was Aaron. It was the brother of Moshe. So while Moshe had already left, was out of Egypt, was raised an Egyptian, was out of Egypt, Aaron was the leader of Jewry. And he was the prophet that God had used to somehow rebuke the Jews, inspire the Jews to maintain their original traditions of Ram Yitzchak V'Yaakov and not to become assimilated. And that's for that reason, the Medrash says, why Moshe was really adamant and did not want to accept the appointment as being the leader of the Jews, because he felt it would be an affront to Aaron, who had already been the God's prophet and had this leadership position. One thing, since we discussed the fact is they abandoned circumcision. They had to, it's hard to know to what extent, but they had adopted idolatry. And again, it's hard to know, we know just as a rule that there's a certain harshness that when even a minority is involved in illicit activity, the community as a whole is held responsible. So it's really hard to know how many of them worshipped idols. We know Levi as a group never did. But it's hard to say that each and every one of the others, or there were just enough of them from every group, and it was idol worship was tolerated, that everyone of mastery, the communal responsibility, everyone was held responsible for that. So it's really hard to know the numbers. We do know that on the other hand, they kept culturally distinct in terms of their language, in terms of their names. They did keep a conduct of morality. They did not speak Lashon Hora ill of others. There was another very interesting activity, whatever, that they were involved in, which made them uniquely Jewish. When Moshe was in the royal palace and an influence on Pharaoh, he prevailed on Pharaoh, on Paro, that the Jews be given off one day a week. Instead of a 7-day work week, it would be a 6-day work week. And he convinced them that if they rest one day, ultimately they will work better. Because you're not freeing them in any case, and you'll get better work out of them if they rest one day. The day that he chose, he was familiar with Jewish tradition, was Shabbos. So Shabbos, from the time that he was... he had been in the royal court to the time when Moses came back, during all of that period of time, which could have been up to 60 years, depending how long, there's a question how long Moses was away from Egypt. Was he away 40 years? Was he away 60 years? Was he away 62 years? Is a question. But during that period of time, the Jews did not work on Shabbos. What did they do on Shabbos? And we quote here on page 12, because when Moses came back and wanted the Jews to be let free, Pharaoh says the problem with the Jews is that they have this day off. So we're going to make it harder. So they already made them work a 7-day work week. And of course, there's a story with the bricks, which we'll discuss in a future lecture, that they didn't, they had to keep their old goals, but yet they had to gather straw themselves. It was not provided for them. So to them by the government. So they really work them without abatement, so they should not think about rebellion. They would be just overworked, and they wouldn't think about anything but just going to sleep and getting their day over with. But when he said, let more work be laid upon the men, this teaches us that, at least originally, they possessed scrolls which they pleasurably occupied themselves each and every Shabbos. Because when they were off, they weren't just off. They really, the scrolls were really, was the record of their history. This was like similar to Sefer Bereishis. And in it, it had, of course, the hope for redemption. And Pharaoh saw this, not just the fact is they had time off, but the activity that they were dreaming of redemption. And it was the basis because they saw, they knew of the covenants, they knew of their history. The message contained in the scroll was that the Holy One, blessed be, would redeem them from slavery. Because they were resting on Shabbos, Pharaoh told them, let more work be laid upon the men that they may labor in it. Let them not regard vain words. In other words, they shouldn't pleasurably occupy themselves with those scrolls, and they shouldn't rest on the day of Shabbos. So when Moshe came back and wanted and said and demanded that from Pharaoh, from Paro, that he freed them, what Pharaoh did was he made them work on Shabbos. So they had that as well. Now, seeing that the Jews only continued to multiply despite the rigors of slavery, Pharaoh set upon a new plan. And this was the plan that he had the Hebrew midwives. He wanted them to kill the males and to keep alive the females. You could read this on your own. This is on page 12. One was named Shifra, the other was Pua. He explains that for a whole nation you can't have just two midwives. In the city of Detroit, how many obstetricians are there? This is not just the midwives who are in addition. He understands as these were, what he did was Pharaoh really instituted an organization of midwifery, that these two would head this, and they would train the others. But of course, he wanted them to institute his thing of the midwives would be a means of getting rid of the males, or at least if they couldn't get rid of all of them, but many of them, so there'd be preponderance of females. And he felt that way would also somehow, eventually those females would marry Egyptians. So it would cull the ranks, it would lessen the ranks of them. The midwives feared God, and you can look yourself on page 13, not only the head midwives, but all of the midwives. And they kept the children alive. And he explains, interestingly, that that not only did they not kill the children, but both the males and the females, they made sure that they lived vigorously, that they invigorated the children, you know, as they act as pediatricians as well, not just as obstetricians. When Pharaoh challenged them, he wasn't challenged. It's interesting how the Netziv learns. His challenge to them was not that they disobeyed him and they did not kill the males. He could understand that. Which is according to Jewish law, you don't kill someone to save your own life. You don't kill someone to save your own life. And there's language, ain't doicha nefesh from a nefesh. Don't push away one soul to save another soul. However, it says, why did you, his thing is, but why did you go against my orders to ensure their life? It's to act as a pediatrician, to help them out. This was really But they were not, this is his critique, but they were not harmed in any case. But what he did do, the next thing is in the Malbim learns similarly, he made houses for them. On one level, according to the Medrash, this is a reward for the midwives. He made those head midwives, Shifra and Pua, were destined to become the mothers that began a whole dynasty of great people. From Shifra came out Moshe, came out Aaron. Aaron was the father of founder of the whole dynasty of Kohanim. Miriam, who was, according to tradition, Pua, according to this tradition, who was, evidently she was a prodigy, but she helped her mother. Shifra was the one who actually acted as the obstetrician and pediatrician. Pua was the one who soothed the child after the child was born. She was granted, from her seed came out David HaMelech, King David. But that's the Midrashic explanation of this. In addition, though, the simple meaning was he created physical homes that the obstetricians, these midwives, should have, that he moved them to their homes. So therefore, when they would be on call and they would get that the woman is about to give birth, they would be told, and there would be an Egyptian in the house there as well. The Egyptian would accompany now these midwives to make sure to kill a male child. This is what this is at least how the Hamakdavar, this was the what he attempted to institute. Of course, he was not successful either. The Medrash here that we quote here it's really the Gemara on Sota on 11b, it's in Midrashic terms, explains that the Egyptians put tremendous effort to try to demoralize the Jews, and that they should not keep on multiplying. And one of them was that they made them work out in the fields far from their homes a whole day, that they had no desire to have marital relations. They were overworked. And what did the Jewish women do? They went out in the fields to meet their husbands and to bring back, says the spirit, a desire to live. And as it says, Revere says, the word for the righteous women who lived in that generation where the Israelites delivered from Egypt. When they went out to draw water, the Holy One, blessed be He, arranged that small fish should enter their pitchers, which they drew up half full of water and half full of fish. Then they set two pots on the fire, one for hot water and one for the fish, which they carried to their husbands in the field, and washed, anointed, and fed, and gave them to drink, and had relations with them, which is this kind of sheepfolds, it's between the raised borders of the field. And it said, and it quotes a verse in Psalms, the reward for you laid amongst them in the borders. Actually, they had relations in between where no one could see them, but it was really as the women who brought life back to their husbands. And therefore, they continued to have children. This was under the eyes of the Egyptians. They risked themselves to do this. And Israel's marriage is the plunder of the Egyptians. And it goes on that they gave birth to the children. The Egyptians attempted to kill these children. The Sagadata records a miracle that these children were saved. The children saw that this was the hand of God. Later on, when the children, by the splitting of the Red Sea, and they saw the visions of the Red Sea, they recognized the hand of God, the Shekhinah that they had seen when they were saved by this. And this is the Agadah of the Gemara records. But one thing in this, all of this, we see the attempt, the Pharaoh, to really totally demoralize them, and it was the women who were really, really responsible for the continuation of the Jews. One wonders, though, you know, such an activity and the fact that they were able to remain steadfast in all of this, you would assume that it came from leadership. Who are the leaders of the Jews? There's an interesting medrash here, which you quote on page 16. This is from Medrash, the Shmois Rabbah's Perek Chovov, in chapter 26. The subject here is referring to the war of Amalek, which is in Parshas B'Shalach, and about that God sends in difficult times. God sends leaders. The leader at the time when Amalek attacked the Jews when they were on their way out of Egypt to Mount Sinai, the leader was Joshua, who led the troops against them. In describing about the history of leadership, it quotes a verse in Job, added a new level of interpretation to the verse, where Eov says, Lo shalavti, says, I had no repose, nor I had rest, nor was I quiet. So basically, he said that and the simple meaning was that I tried my hardest, you know, to live a good life. Says, yet trouble came. He was describing his own tzoras, his own difficulty. But they use that verse to explain that the difficulties of the Jews as a people. I had no repose refers to the first decree. The Pharaoh made against me, the Jewish people, as it says, and they made their lives bitter. And the Holy One blessed me, established a redeemer. This was Miriam. Her name referred to the bitterness which they experienced. And one wonders, how did she, what did she do? And it could very well be that in the midst of this bitterness which was created, that the Jews should have no desire to continue to have children. She was the one in the face of this bitterness to inspire the women. We know she led the women at the splitting of the Red Sea after the Jews were safe and the Egyptians were killed. She led them in song. She was a leader. Could very well be it's referring to her leadership. And that's where the women, the Nashim Tzidkoniyos, the righteous women, were really inspired by Miriam. Nor did I rest, refers to the second decree, and this is, we discussed before, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. This was the attempt of Pharaoh to make sure that the males be killed. He was not successful. Though blessed be established a redeemer, this was Aaron. His name referred to the conception. He royon, hora is to conceive. Aharon, that has the hey, resh, nun, the conception. The I will conceive. There's a heroyon, which they want to deter and destroy. His name is that the Jews will conceive. Could very well be he was a leader amongst the Jews. Nor was I quiet, refers to the third decree, as it says, every son who is born you shall throw into the river. The Holy One blessed be established a redeemer, Moses, Moshe, whose name refers to waters, it says, because I drew him out of the water. It was really when he was born, the decree to destroy every male, as we were going to discuss in the future lecture, came to an end. So it was even before he was a redeemer, but his coming to the world, when he came, the astrologers saw that there was no... I'm going ahead of myself, which I'm going to discuss in a future lecture. The reason Pharaoh was so desperate to kill every male was his astrologer saw a sign from heaven that the Redeemer of Israel was born. And that his fears of the Jews being this nation that would cause harm to the Egyptians would be realized. Therefore, he decreed that every male, and he wasn't even sure at that point if it's just a Jewish male or is this an Egyptian male. He had for a short period of time every male to be killed. And then the astrologer saw a sign in heaven that says that there was no problem anymore of the Redeemer. At that point, that's when really when Moses was thrown into the river. Because at that point, the decree came to an end. He was the vehicle that made the decree come to the end. And of course, because he eventually was the Redeemer. But he was the third leader of the Jews. Because, and he says, and this, yet trouble came, in this verse of Job refers to Amalek. Finally, after when they went through the whole Egyptian experience, they were enslaved. There was attempts to have them totally, the male population totally killed. They survived all of that, and yet trouble came in Amalek. So this is how the verse, and the leader there was Yahshua's Joshua. But it would seem to be that these were leaders in Egypt. We know Aaron was a prophet in Egypt. So it really stands to reason that really part of the inspiration that they had was from Miriam and Aaron. And we end off here, this is the last citation. When Aaron died, he was mourned by the entire Jewish people. Men, women, children. He said there were many thousands amongst the children of Israel who were called Aaron. In his honor. For had it not been for Aaron, they wouldn't have come into this world. He was involved very much in making sure that the marital problems would be settled and there would be shalom bias. People did not get divorced. And as a result, many children were born. And it's an honor, it's a tribute to the person who who caused their marriage to be re-cemented, they named the child Aaron. When did this occur? Well, in the 40 years, and it's possible, but Aaron was extremely busy. He was the Kohen Gadol. He was the high priest. It's hard to say that he was, you know, he had many respect. He was responsible in teaching. And it stands to reason, at least part of this, where he was involved in helping and communal, was, well, there were still slaves in Egypt. He wasn't enslaved himself. He was a free man. And he, to the extent that he could, he was involved in cementing the Jewish family. So we see that despite all of the attempts to demoralize the Jews, to destroy the Jews, Hashem really still stood by them and sent inspired leaders to ensure, says, that the Jews continue on. We'll continue on, Mitzvah Hashem, says in the next lecture. This is in terms of the life of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu, his birth, and how he eventually became the Redeemer, and how the Jews were redeemed from slavery. Now, are there any questions? Yeah.
You mentioned about embalming.
Yeah, the question about the embalming. I didn't touch this at all. The question about the embalming. Normally, embalming is not Jewish practice. How embalming is practiced even today is involved with letting out really all of the blood and then putting embalming fluid into the body instead. According to halacha, this is not normally allowed. How embalming was practiced in Egypt, at least as we know, was practiced at a later date, involved even more than just putting embalming fluids. It involved of taking out all the internal organs. And they were also dried, as well as the body was dried in salt. It was a whole complex thing. It really took the 40 days. It was described, and Herodotus explains this in his book, how it was practiced in his time. Normally, such a thing would not be allowed in Jewish law. So there are two schools of thought that I'm familiar with. One is Joseph had no choice in the matter. This was they viewed him as a deity of sorts. He was Jacob was the one who ended the famine. He had no this. He did what he could do. At least he got him buried into Eretz Yisrael, and that took some doing. But he couldn't stop the embalming. I think this is the approach which Sham Shem Fol Hirsch takes. There are others who say that he was embalmed, but it was not done under the normative way that anything was severed, but the other embalming procedure was done. So he was embalmed, but it didn't involve the nivul hames. In other words, the desecration of the body to open up. Really, what they did was they opened up, took out the internal organ, they took out the brain too. They through the skull, they're able to take out the brain tissue. And then they had that dried, and then the whole body was dried, and they put the internal organs in this thing called canopic jars, in the special jars, and they were buried together with the person himself. So that view is that it wasn't really it was embalming, but it was a Yiddish embalming. You know, you know how it is. You know, probably pay off a few people here and there, and it's. But that's the other school of thought. Okay, yeah.
I'm asking this question in the context of last week's lecture. You mentioned that Yaakov was buried with Leah. Why wasn't he buried with Rachel?
Oh, so that's a very good question. The question is that we know that he's buried, Yaakov was buried with Leah, but his real wife, his chief wife, was Rachel. That was the one he really felt as being a kindred spirit. We discussed last. Leah had a very different personality. She was destined to be the mother of all these, of half, a full half of Klal Yisrael. And she was and she added to the people, but she wasn't, they didn't have that chemistry. And the reason is Yaakov had to explain he had to really explain this problem to his son Yosef. when Yaakov asked to be buried, asked that he be buried in Machpelah, he had to, and he wanted Yosef to do this because he had the royal power. He had to explain himself, why didn't he bury his mother, Rachel, Yosef's mother, in Machpelah? And he explained that she died on the way, and he felt he had to bury her approximately where she had died. But the Medrash explains that he saw that it was important for her to be buried separately. There was a role for her to be played in having been buried in a special place. That's this Kever Rachel. It's really on the way. When you go to Jerusalem, to Hebron, you pass by the Kever Rachel. Is when the Jews were exiled in Babylon, they also passed that grave. And they prayed by her gravesite. And it was really, the position where the land, the location of her burial was important to make it accessible for the Jews to be a shrine, a place where they could pray. So that's, but it is a, it's a complex problem. It was not something that was his desire. It was basically, it was like a divine order that he buried her there. So he felt it was God's hand, and it wasn't really something of his choice. Okay, good to know.